If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 537, H-1B Mission Creep, with guest Kevin Lin, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019. What I have for you in this episode of the podcast is a radio show from a couple weeks back. And I don't know why it's taken me so long to get it up as a podcast, but the subject matter is not one that is, you know, super topical, or it's not one that's going to get old anytime soon. When I say it's not super topical, that's not to say it isn't important. It is very important. It's just not something that's tied to the news cycle. So before I play this for you, I need to disclose that, as I've mentioned on several occasions, I do a weekly webcomic for a political organization called the Center for Progressive Urban Politics, for which I am paid. The head of the Center for Progressive Urban Politics, or CFPUP, is also the head of U.S. Tech Workers, which is a political organization which advocates on behalf of tech workers who are United States citizens. The head of both organizations is Kevin Lin, the guest on this episode of the podcast. So you'll hear, this was a live radio show, and Kevin thought that the end time was actually the beginning time. So in the beginning, he's not on the line. And so I'm filling some time, playing some YouTube videos, and trying to get in touch with him to get him on the line. The only thing that I have cut out from the conversation are the local... It's not even part of the conversation because Kevin wasn't on the line yet. I've cut out the local public service announcements that I read at the top of the hour on the radio show. All right, here is my conversation about immigration with Kevin Lin of U.S. Tech Workers.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Different, brave, lively, substantial. This is Black Sheep Radio, WOOL-FM, 91.5 Bellows Falls, community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls. It is a cold day. My truck wouldn't start. I had to walk here to the radio station. Woe is me. No, it's okay. It was brisk. The guest for this hour has not yet called in, so I'm not sure if he's going to. I will proceed on the assumption that he'll be calling any second now, and I'll tell you that at the Bellows Falls Opera House Movie Theater. Alrighty, well, there are the announcements dispatched. Let me read something to you. This is from the website ustechworkers.com. A history of decline of the U.S. tech worker. Perception is everything. If asked for a first impression, an average respondent might think U.S. tech workers today are highly paid, successful, and well-employed. They would be basing that view upon a memory of how things used to be. Memory, in the collective consciousness of a baby boomer generation, is of highly creative efforts that were the impetus for new and unprecedented industries in tech and many other tech-related sectors that provided opportunity to many to benefit in the form of jobs, education, and a high standard of living. To be a tech worker in the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s indeed was a gold ticket synonymous with a flexible, comfortable lifestyle. Along with that, vulnerable workers were perceived as the low-skilled. Fast forward to the present. What a different situation presents itself for U.S. tech workers as a result of the combination of unfair labor and trade practices, as well as the impact of the H-1B visa program. Through H-1Bs, companies imported large numbers of foreign workers. They still do, at the price of transforming the job landscape so drastically that today, the impossible becomes a shocking fact. Only 29% of tech jobs in California's Silicon Valley go to Americans. That's even with the high demand for STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math workers. wage suppression, and anecdotes of tech workers training the less qualified foreign replacements have now become the norm. Now, it's the highly skilled tech worker who has become vulnerable. This is what inspires our movement to unite tech workers and pressure the federal government for visa reform. Please join us in the fight to ensure that companies hire U.S. tech workers first. Alrighty, so again, that is from the website ustechworkers.com. If this is a topic that is of interest to you, you might check it out. A related organization is called Progressives for Immigration Reform. And the head of both of those organizations is Kevin Lynn, who I had thought would be calling in here about 5 minutes ago. All right, so I think what I will do right now is first mute this YouTube video and get past the commercial, and then I'm going to play just a short segment from the Economic Times. This was published just 2 days ago, and it is about President Trump's tweet on the topic of H-1B visa holders.
In some good news for Indian techies, Donald Trump has promised to overhaul visa rules for H-1B holders, including a path to citizenship. Chandra Shrikant is joining in with more details. Well, Chandra, if Mr. Trump's tweet is anything to go by, then it's good news for Indian IT techies.
On the face of it, this seems like a big positive for techies. People employed not just with Indian companies but also multinational companies on a H-1B visa, because President Trump has tweeted he wants to reassure H-1B holders that changes coming in this visa will be for simplicity. It will also ensure a path to citizenship. And he's also sought to reassure that wants to encourage talented and highly skilled people to pursue career options in the U.S.
Okay, give a call.
This is a very different tune compared to what the U.S. was saying all along, where they want to protect local jobs. Trump clearly saying that they want highly skilled people there, which is why the new norms will bring in both simplicity and certainty. Now, the other piece of certainty was on the spouses of H-1B visa holders, people on H-4 visas. Trump also wanted to take away employment benefits from them, but will they be allowed to work? Will there be changes to that as well? That's something that we have to watch out for. But remember, this is the most popular visa used by companies seeking to send professionals to the U.S. And Indians corner a majority of H-1B visas, not just Indian IT companies, but also MNCs such as Microsoft, Google, IBM, Accenture, and others. So on the face of it, this certainly looks like a positive move as far as software professionals are concerned.
We're joined now, Melissa, by Steve Forbes, the Forbes Media Chairman, to talk a little bit more about all of this. And, you know, to this idea about impact, obviously, as Mike talks about and members of Congress have talked about, there are individual federal workers and those who rely on them who are impacted. What's your view on the macro effects, though? Do we just make it up down the line, or are you starting to get concerned?
I don't think the macro effects are going to be that great. Individual cases, absolutely.
Yeah.
Budgets and things like that, family budgets. But in terms of the nation, no, we can absorb this fairly easily. But I think this morning, President Trump had a very unusual tweet about H-1B visa workers.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, too.
And I think that's almost breadcrumbs out there saying, as part of a deal, Silicon Valley is right next to Nancy Pelosi.
I agree. Yeah, let me just read the tweet first. It's H-1B holders in the United States can rest assured changes are coming. We'll bring both simplicity and certainty to their stay, including a potential path to citizenship. We want to encourage talented and highly skilled people to pursue career options in the U.S. So this visa program, and you were starting to get to this point. Sorry to interrupt, Steve.
Not at all.
Explain it a little bit. Is really important to many of those technology companies in Silicon Valley, where they have an opportunity to hire a foreign worker to fill a need. And now the president's talking about, I guess, maybe having those workers stay here permanently. So,
which would bring great certainty to Silicon Valley. And also, I bet you before this is over, they'll increase the number of visas. They go in a matter of days each year.
Right.
And so I think this is going to be part of a package.
So that was Steve Forbes of Forbes Media speaking on Fox News about the president's change of heart on the topic of the H-1B visa. And somebody who knows more about that than I do is Kevin Lynn of U.S. Tech Workers. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, KMO, thanks so much for having me on today.
Oh, it is my pleasure. This is an important topic.
Well, it really is. It really came back into vogue with President Trump's tweet, and it was funny. I knew something was up when I was out for my – usually at 6:30 a.m., I'm out the door on my daily walk, and right before 7 a.m., my cell phone started lighting up. As people started to read the tweet, and maybe what I should do is read that tweet to everyone so that everyone has it.
Go ahead.
Okay, so Donald Trump, real Donald Trump, H-1B holders in the United States can rest assured that changes are soon coming, which will bring both simplicity and certainty to your stay, including a potential path to citizenship. We want to encourage talented and highly skilled people to pursue career options in the U.S. So that was the tweet. And as you could imagine, if you're a tech worker, someone who's been displaced by an H-1B visa holder, which happens a great deal, if you're someone who is getting a degree in computer science and you're concerned that your ability to make a living is being impinged upon by abuse of employment visa programs, because it's not just H-1B, it's programs like OPT, J-1, and now H-4 coming on, and several others. But I'd like to kind of take apart that tweet, because there are a number of balls in play here. And to give some background, the H-1B visa was created in 1990 as a way to help shore up the people needed to help get ready for Y2K. And that's what was really, I mean, a lot of these workers coming over were involved in prepping for Y2K, changing that code. And what it did was it opened up, it created opportunities for third-party placement firms, folks that dominate the absolutely. And think about, from 1992 to 1994, I worked for Ross Perot, who was he ran as an independent for president in 1992. And we were fighting NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, because at that time it was the manufacturing base that they wanted to offshore. And they did a great job of it. I mean, it's amazing to me how people bought off on this propaganda that, remember, I don't know if you recall KMO, but at the time, the phrase was, there are jobs that don't have an economic right to exist. I'm like, these are good middle-class jobs, good manufacturing jobs. You don't need to go to college, assume all that debt. You could actually go right into the workforce and be able to afford an apartment, buy a truck, and, you know, get on your own. And that was hollowed out of this. I mean, you're really lucky to have a manufacturing job anymore. And so it has moved then from jobs that are less skilled to jobs that are highly skilled. And H-1B is emblematic of that, where, as you're saying, this is a way to hollow out the middle class, to increase corporate profits. And as I mentioned, it's not just tech workers. I'll give you a great example. We have another website called Doctors Without Jobs. And I was at an H-1B rally in front of the White House a couple years ago, and I was talking to a fellow who had graduated from George Washington University as a doctor. And after he graduated, he didn't get a residency. Now, if you're a doctor and you don't get a residency, you'll never get a license. And if you don't get a license, you'll never be able to practice. What I didn't know was about 1,100 doctors who graduated from good U.S. medical colleges, and I'm not talking like the Caribbean schools or anything like that, don't get residencies. But at the same time, 3,700, roughly speaking, every year, foreign-trained physicians get residencies at U.S. teaching hospitals. And you got to wonder, I mean, here is someone, here are people, roughly 1,100 people a year, that go through a U.S. medical college. And in the case of this fellow, he now has, he's been out of college now for several years. He has over $450,000 in debt because the interest just keeps accumulating. So these are people who paid into the system, and they're being denied the opportunity to move forward. And a lot of it is, again, the exploitation of these programs. If you know, the whether it's the AMA, I haven't been able to quite get to the bottom. It's actually a number of different groups that I believe share the blame in this. But the fewer doctors you have, the more they can make. Because they know that if you have three doctors and not six doctors at a location, the three doctors will see a lot more patients, they'll spend more time with the patients, but they'll ultimately make more profit. Whereas it goes back to the, in the hospital lore, there's a theory that if you build a bed or, like expand your hospital, add more beds, you're going to fill a bed and you'll probably make less profit. So there are forces like that engaged. So it's not just unskilled, semi-skilled labor. All skilled labor is under attack right now. And at the time when we really need to see Americans pursuing advanced degrees and taking advantage of what is an amazing education system, a lot have to be looking at this and saying, why would I do a career in tech? Why would I go into medicine? Why would I go into accounting? Absolutely. Sorry. Once again, I got a little long-winded there.
You are listening to C-Realm Radio on WOOL-FM, 91.5 Bellows Falls, Vermont. I am your host, KMO, and my guest this week is Kevin Lynn, who is a political organizer, and one of his organizations is U.S. Tech Workers. Kevin, before you called in, I read the About section from the website U.S. Tech Workers that mentions that only 29% of tech jobs in Silicon Valley go to Americans. So earlier in the program, you were talking about how not all H-1B visa holders are highly skilled, but clearly lots of highly skilled Americans who would have to be highly skilled to hold these jobs are not working jobs in Silicon Valley because most of them seem to be going to foreign workers.
Yes. These things build on their own. There's a social Darwinism I'm finding that takes hold in a company. You know, people tend to hire their own. So as foreign workers have moved up in these systems, they have begun to hire more and more of their own. Also, they're getting, when you look at the prevailing wages versus the wages paid these workers, they work for much less. So they are very attractive to these companies to hire. And let me get into probably, because there are a number of ills that go with this. And one of the biggest casualties of this has been equal opportunity employment, EEOC. Some facts, I mean, U.S. female tech workforce is declining. Female tech wages are declining. The disparity between female and male wages, the disparity is increasing. Female tech worker rights are diminishing, as we saw recently play out at Google. Female tech leaders are rapidly being replaced by foreign-born female tech leaders. tech industry female executives are in rapid decline. Female tech venture funding capital is really almost impossible. You know, very few female tech ventures are funded anymore. U.S. female STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, and math students, are declining at U.S. universities as foreign female STEM workers are increasing. U.S. female students in K-12 are choosing at greater and greater numbers not to choose STEM careers. And the powerful fact behind this is women today represent just 12% of all computer science graduates. In 1984, they represented 37%. So that's a huge decline. We are not going on the right trajectory there. Again, so as we talked about, you know, when you look at wages, but also when you look at equal opportunity, we're going backward. And this is all a result of the saturation of the tech industry and now other industries with foreign workers.
You sure it's not the patriarchy?
Well, the patriarchy has always been there. But again, women went from 12% of computer science graduates in 1984 to 37%. And yes, the patriarchy is definitely involved. I did a show a couple months ago with four women who are veterans of the technology space. And between all of them, you're looking at about 90 years of experience in the workforce. And they looked at it because, again, 74% of H-1B visa holders come from India. You know, it's a very patriarchal place. It is more than that. They actually even have a caste system still. So female workers, these are the environments that they're being pushed into, and as a result are finding that tech work is less and less attractive a place to be. So it is definitely a patriarchy, and it's a patriarchy as, you know, we've seen on a number of cases in recent that have been making headlines about Silicon Valley. You know, these are companies that don't practice EEOC and seem to have been getting a pass on it.
And for those not familiar with the acronym EEOC?
Oh, Equal Employment Opportunity.
So you mentioned the Indian caste system. How does that play out in terms of which Indians come to the U.S. to take tech jobs?
Well, it's all the Brahmin class for the most part. One class, one caste. So it's not like we're getting, if the goal is diversity, we're not getting it. We're not getting that. We're not getting diversity in women. We're not getting diversity in culture. We're basically getting a monolithic patriarchal culture that comes mostly from one or two states in India, one caste system, and is 70% male.
Now, who is it that makes the decision to hire a Brahmin as opposed to a member of a lower caste?
Well, it's not made here at the U.S. Well, recently there was a class action suit brought against Tata Consultancy Services. And Tata is an Indian-based outsourcing company that has a number of people working here in the U.S. and much more working in India. So they're the ones making those, they're the ones who are actually applying for the H-1B visas. You see, the current head of USCIS, Frank Cisna, who I think is an amazingly competent person, he has a strong background with that agency. He's a great leader. And when he was talking about the H-1B visa program, he said, ideally, the way the program should work is, let's just say I'm working with ABC company and I go to a campus to recruit. And I find this fellow from India that I think is really sharp. and I'd like to have them on our team, then I should file that H-1B visa for that particular person, for this particular job. But what happens is, now 85,000 H-1B visas are approved every year. It's in reality 65,000. There's another 25,000 that are cut off for government and other areas. But there are hundreds of thousands of applications put in. So this is what the fellow was talking about. I think it was Bloomberg who was being interviewed, was talking about, oh, my God, these applications are scooped up all at once. Yes, because hundreds of thousands are poured in. And these applications are made out by, for the most part, by these third-party consulting firms. I remember speaking to a reporter from San Antonio, Texas, and he was saying, why are there so many H-1B visa applications for Texas? I go, well, that's because that's where emphasis is. So these workers, once they get them, they'll scatter them throughout the country, you know, working in different U.S.-based companies. But, yeah, so... Did I answer your question there, KMO?
I think so. Rather than have you elaborated on it, though, I want to move on to the next question, which is, when talking about U.S. jobs and the erosion of the middle class and global economic paradigms and business, you know, international business, the erosion of the middle class and global economic paradigms and business, you know, international business. It's very strange that we could be, you know, 3/4 of an hour into such a conversation and neither one of us has mentioned the word China. This is a very India-centric discussion. What's the China angle on all this?
China, about 20% of H-1B visa applications are for China. They're another big player in this. Chinese really dominate students are all over the U.S. education system working, you know, pursuing STEM degrees. Let's actually expand it out a little more. Another one of the ills associated with this, because oftentimes when a company outsources its workforce and to one of these, like an Infosys or a Capgemini, that's really an intermediate step. The goal then is to move those jobs overseas along with the data and the management of the data. So right now, huge swaths of our healthcare information of individual Americans and the systems is residing overseas. Our insurance information is residing overseas. Our financial information is residing overseas. And this is a security problem. China doesn't allow this. Russia doesn't allow this. There were just rules implemented in Europe to avoid this. I mean, if people are worried about Russians hacking into our systems, ultimately, what will happen when all of our data is residing overseas? And Prime Minister Modi of India is calling for what he calls localization, which is all data stays in India. It doesn't leave India. So this, we have a big national security issue with this as well. And think about it from just another aspect. So let's say something nefarious is going on in the company. What's the likelihood of someone on an H-1B visa to report some of that? They're not really a stakeholder here in the company or the country. So if they see something that might have national security implications, they're not going to report. That's one of my big concerns. That's not a big concern, but it's certainly a facet that needs to be reviewed with this. So,
well, particularly under the Obama administration, whistleblowers got hammered. It didn't matter what your citizenship status was. I mean, Edward Snowden's an American citizen.
Yeah, and what was the fellow, Binney at NSA? And they're changing the FASB rules now, the accounting rules, to allow for secret budgets. So think of the implications there. Now you have who's managing that data. Well, they don't have an allegiance to this country. So there are just a lot of ills that accompany this. And at a very elemental level, anyone in America looking at these programs, it should be creating some level of dissonance with them in that, wait a minute. All right, I got a kid in school. They're going to come out with, let's say, moderately $65,000 in student loans. Now, they got a degree in computer science. How marketable is that going to be in a world where we are bringing people in to do that work and offshoring that work? This is really the time for Congress to hear from all Americans. And, you know, it's as we've seen with NAFTA, GATT, once these jobs are gone, they do not come back.
You know, it could be that in a few years we'll look back on this time when human jobs were being shuffled around the planet, you know, to save money for companies and to give them more power over their workers. And we'll think of it as, you know, our concern that we showed as being really quaint, given that AI has basically taken all of those jobs.
Yeah, I've talked to Hillary Gamm, the author of Billions Lost about AI, and her take is kind of is similar to mine in that I think AI has great potential to create more efficiencies, enhance effectiveness, spare workers from going into dangerous places. But ultimately, technology has always been a force multiplier. It's always created jobs. What's not what's happening with these visa programs is these potential jobs. And I like to use the example, you know, in the late 1970s, I had a IBM Selectric typewriter. And it was really neat. And it had, you know, if you... The cool thing about it was if you made a mistake, you would put in a whiteout cartridge, type over it, and you could just continue on. But then in like 1984, I got exposed to WordStar. Wow, that was this amazing piece of technology, a word processing software. And yeah, I mean, IBM lost its typewriter business, but many, many, many more jobs in different sectors and verticals have been created as a result of this information technology explosion. So I don't fear AI from a job standpoint. What I fear is the movement of people into the country to take these good jobs, or as they're even the threat of them being used to push down wages and benefits of Americans, and then the offshoring of these jobs. That's where we don't get the benefit from technology.
Speaking about these topics and taking the positions that you do, particularly in progressive circles, I imagine that you get a fair amount of pushback of people accusing you of either racism or nationalism or ethnocentrism. Why shouldn't the U.S. share the wealth and give workers from other places a chance?
Well, because I think it's important for, you know, I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I and several other citizens of our local county were out leafleting houses in this township to get people to a township supervisor meeting this Monday to fight a development. And that's citizenship in action. And I think you have to play where you are. These other countries, they have to bring themselves up. We can't, I mean, everyone who wants, and I know you and I are probably very simpatico here, but it seems that everyone who talks about, oh, these jobs don't have an economic right to exist, oh, we need to share the wealth, oh, we need to equalize things around the world. These are the ones who, at least at the time that they're saying it, don't think they're going to be impacted. They don't think their job is going to get moved overseas. And it's so fun. I knew someone at in the late 90s was saying just that to me, and they worked for a large consumer packaged goods company, and they thought their job was amazingly secure. And then one day they were called in and said, well, you can either move to Brazil or you can leave. So, yeah, it's to me, you got to play where you are in this world. We can't bring these other companies up or countries up, because when we do, what we've done is created this enormous disparity in income. I mean, the neoliberal doctrine that seems to have it's like a manifest destiny with all of this is the free movement of capital and people around the world. Recently, a fellow described it as the invade and invite paradigm, where we invade a country and then we invite a few people to come here to kind of make an atonement. But again, it's when this capital moves like it does, it doesn't care about it, it just sees things in terms of GDP and maximizing profits. It doesn't look at quality of life. It doesn't look at the family, the community. Are they being reinforced? And, you know, to me, it's a destructive cycle versus a virtuous cycle. It's like organic farming versus normal conventional till farming. With organic, over time, you build up that soil. You get more and more soil year over year over year. With conventional tilling, farming, pesticides, all that, you get less and less soil, and you get more and more inputs that need to be put on the soil to make it grow something. And that's a destructive cycle. And what we see now is students spending a lot of money to go to college and get skills, and they're not finding the work. They're not able to leave home. And that's emblematic of a lot of this. Is H-1B the one factor doing it all? No, but it's certainly contributing to it.
So until just a few days ago, President Trump, probably not your ally across the board, but at least on the topic of immigration, you had shared interests. Who has he betrayed in order to make this change? And what sort of pushback is he likely to face, do you think?
He's going to face a lot of pushback from his base on this. As I mentioned, tech workers, my cell phone was going off by 7 a.m. And I think he's going to hear a lot of pushback on this from his base. For instance, regardless of where one stands on the shutdown, there was a poll that was released this morning that shows that even though the majority of Americans, by I think it's 54% of Americans, oppose the wall, 45% are for it, and that's up from 34%. So he's really going against his base here, and I think it could jeopardize his chances in 2020. And also, I think it also speaks to the success that tech workers had in the last legislature. We pretty much defeated H.R. 392, this bill to remove the country caps. And, you know, I haven't cast judgment yet on Trump's tweet. And the reason is this. The one thing I didn't mention when going over the tweet or go into was his use of the word simplicity. Now, Hillary Gann, the author of Billions Lost, in her book, when she looks at one of the cures to this, is to simplify our employment, our entire visa program system. And if we do that, we make employment visas, don't make them dual intent. We get rid of J1s, HB1s, OPTs, L1s, and there's only, or H4 and H4s, and we have only one employment visa, and we have a number associated to that. I think that would go a long way. And he used that in his tweet. And we have had conversations in the past with people in the White House. I know they've seen Hillary's book. So, and it's like anything else, until I see some legislation, it's hard for me to go either way. But I will say tech workers are definitely upset with this. They feel betrayed. And I think it's something where I think if the president were shrewd and looking to 2020, he would want to reevaluate what he said.
I've been talking with Kevin Lin of USTechWorkers.com. Kevin, we've reached the end of the hour, but it's
been... Wow, that went fast.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But it has been very informative, so thank you very much.
Great. Can I say one quick thing?
If it takes less than 20 seconds.
Okay. January 26th at the Hartford, Connecticut Elks Lodge, 34 Prospect Street, Hartford, Connecticut. Tech worker John Roberts is having a potluck to fight the $14 million in...
On the Sea Realm podcast... A mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, to its old dimensions.
All right, that's all for this episode of the Sea Realm podcast. If you would, do me a favor, check out the Geb webcomic. It's GEBB.io is where you can find it. Hopefully, you know, if we can build a large enough readership for that, it will morph into something more than just a webcomic. We're thinking about an animated series of some kind. And I would very much like to do not only character design and artistic work on that, but also voice work. But to get there, we need to build a following for that comic strip. So if you would, check it out. Again, the website is Geb, that's G-E-B-B, Golf Echo Bravo Bravo, .io. And also, I put up daily YouTube videos now. My YouTube channel is called Out of My Head. But if you go to YouTube and you search for Out of My Head, you will find all manner of stuff, none of which is my YouTube channel. So, I've said this before, I kind of cringe when I say it, but if you want to find my videos, do a search for Humans Suck. I don't believe that, but I did a video with that title, and it is my most popular video, unfortunately. But that is the YouTube search that will get you to my content. So if you would, check it out. I would appreciate it. Alrighty, and finally, before I go, thank you so much to everybody who subscribes to the Sea Realm Vault podcast. The Vault subscribers hear a lot more of my voice than the regular Sea Realm podcast listeners who don't also subscribe to the Vault. And, you know, not just my voice, but the voices of the people that I talk to, and more importantly, the ideas of the people whose work I follow. And a bit of my own synthesis in there as well. And with that, I will bid you goodbye. I will talk to you again pretty soon. Vault listeners, I will talk to you again very soon. And until you next hear my voice, please stay well.